7 years ago, Edward Snowden, then an intelligence contractor, leaked those thousands of classified documents from America's National Security Agency, or NSA. Bombshell revelations about the 21st century surveillance state that had risen up since 9/11. Barton Gellman was one of three journalists chosen by Edward Snowden to receive this extraordinary trove of files back in 2013, and went on to lead a team at the Washington Post whose reporting on the NSA surveillance activities earned them the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service in 2014, just one of three Pulitzers that Barton has won thus far for his investigative reporting. Now a staff writer for The Atlantic, he's written a new book, Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the Surveillance State, where he reveals what it was really like to report on what he describes as the most consequential public leak in the history of US intelligence. And Barton, welcome to our little program.
Very glad to be here.
I mentioned you were one of three journalists. The others were Laura Poitras, the filmmaker, and who was the third? Oh, Glenn Greenwald, who I've had on the program, yeah. How did it happen?
Well, I was approached by Laura Poitras, who had received an anonymous tip from someone calling himself Virax, or truth teller in Latin. And Virax claimed to be an intelligence community member who had a scandal to reveal. And my first reaction when Laura came to me was, oh no, not this again. Because if you're a national security reporter, you get a lot of disturbed people who imagine plots by the intelligence community. But this one turned out to be something different.
You think you were being vetted for a while by Snowden?
I was. I was vetting him, and he was vetting me. I wanted to know whether this Virax really knew what he was talking about and really had intelligence documents, as he purported to have. He wanted to know whether he could trust me as a member of the mainstream media, someone who had grown up at the Washington Post, to publish despite government opposition. He was worried that we would bend and agree to kill the story if the government asked us to.
I've had a long relationship with Julian Assange, and I must say it's sometimes been difficult and problematic. I think that's understating it in terms of your relationship with Snowden.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know both of them, though I know Snowden much better. I would say Assange is far the more difficult personality, but Snowden and I had a rather fraught relationship over the years. He stopped talking to me from time to time if he didn't like something I did. We struggled a lot over boundaries. He didn't want to talk about himself or his history or anything about him personally. He wanted to talk strictly about the issues as he saw them. But ultimately, we trusted each other. And I learned a great deal from him.
I understand that in 2013 you wrote a profile which referred to Snowden's alias of Virax, exposing this online handle that he was using. Next day he vanishes from the hidden server.
That's right, and he didn't talk to me for about 2 months after that. He just disappeared. And the nature of these connections is that they can disappear, that they are intermittent, and both sides have to be on at the same time. So when I went looking, I didn't find him there. But we eventually reconciled.
Yes, and his new handle that seems to ill-conceal a rebuke to you is something akin to Bart Sucks.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I don't want to say the new handle because it's both his sort of anonymous nickname and also the name of an account that he was using, and I'd rather not expose that. But it was meant to be a rebuke.
You did end up meeting Snowden in person, as you've already indicated, but the second time I believe, in Moscow, where, of course, he ended up after the US cancelled his passport. And it's important for the listener to understand that you are not interested in the labelling debate, whether he's a hero, a traitor, a whistleblower, or a criminal. But would you be good enough to tell me your personal impression of him?
He is supremely self-confident. He is quite convinced of his point of view. He has an ideology of openness and of liberty. He is not terribly tolerant of disagreement, although he's happy to debate his point of view. He can be prickly and difficult. He can also be sort of relaxed and funny. He's a self-educated man, very wide reading, and rather interesting to talk to.
I didn't really realize that he was an autodidact. I always assumed that he'd been splendidly educated.
No, in fact, he got sick with mononucleosis in high school and never came back. He earned his high school equivalency degree, the GED, as they call it here, and then went on to take college courses, one or two at a time, here and there, and engineering certificates. So he would take advanced engineering courses and either pay attention or not pay attention, and either show up or not show up in the class, and then he would go and ace the final exam, so he would get these certifications.
All sorts of qualities and failings are projected both onto Snowden and Assange. And you write that Snowden, for example, is painted as hungry for fame, but you don't believe that's the case.
No, he had spent his early career as a sort of quiet intelligence person. He had never talked to reporters before. He deflected all questions about himself and kept on saying, the story is not me, the story is the surveillance. That's what you need to pay attention to.
You were right that I had expected to find a man embattled and alone, in hiding, possibly full of regret for the life he had lost, disorientated by a language and culture he did not understand. What did you find instead?
I thought, in essence, that I would find someone who was confused and perhaps even regretful, who hadn't realized quite how isolated he'd become. But I found someone who was going on with his life more or less as he had lived it, because he's a guy who spends all his waking hours in front of a computer screen, whose social and intellectual and work and entertainment life are all on the screen. And he was satisfied with what he had wrought. He eventually got his girlfriend to move to Moscow, and they married. And his life in front of the screen in Moscow is not very different than it is in front of the screen in Hawaii.
Snowden said to you, and I love this quote, one of the very interesting things about doing the right thing is that you have no trouble sleeping. Now, the Snowden story was, of course, the scoop of a lifetime, of any journalist's lifetime, but how does one report on something of this size and scale? I mean, you received tens of thousands of documents at once with no real warning.
No, there was no warning at all. In fact, all the many weeks that I was negotiating with Snowden or Virax before the first documents arrived, I thought we were talking about one document, that he was going to have one highly sensitive document. And indeed, the first transmission that he sent was one document. And then the second one was 50,000 more, which I'd not been expecting.
And
the truth is, I found that overwhelming. It was an amazing opportunity. It was a burden and a responsibility, because I realized right away that there were things in there I would never publish. And it was a puzzle. How do I go about confirming and verifying and authenticating this material?
The things you'd never publish, for example.
Well, I can't give you the exact example because I'm never going to disclose it. But, you know, there are cases in which there are photographs and names of clandestine U.S. operatives in the field. There are photographs and names of intelligence targets who are being intercepted, you know, sort of as we speak, at least as we spoke back then, who were plotting acts of violence against the United States. There were secret shipments of weapons of mass destruction components that were being tracked by surveillance. These are operations that, if disclosed, would have ended. And any friend of my country would not want them to end.
Bart Gellman, you've talked about a problematic or a difficult relationship with Snowden. You choose to go to the Washington Post, with whom you've had or had had a problematic and difficult relationship.
I had had a fantastic, you know, 21-year career at the Post, and it was everything I could have wanted. I became disillusioned by the direction of one editor and decided it was time to leave the paper. But that editor was gone by the time I returned, and the place was run by one of the great figures in American journalism, Marty Baron.
And they backed you, or he backed you, unflinchingly.
Absolutely unflinchingly, everything you could have wanted. He took risks for himself and for the paper in order to get this story out. And I tell that scene by scene in Dark Mirror. I reproduce the moments in which big decisions were made inside the newsroom, and I reproduce a lot of the dialogue with Snowden because so much of it happened on the keyboard.
Talking about keyboards, 2 weeks after the Snowden story broke, your iPad was broken into remotely, and this was the first intrusion into your digital life, but far from the last.
No, I was the target of sustained and sophisticated hacking efforts by more than one foreign intelligence service, and no doubt by private hackers as well. But the iPad was hacked in front of my eyes as I was holding it. The screen guttered out, came back on, and started to inform me that it was discarding the operating system, loading a new kernel, obtaining root access, and so forth, so that if I had not seen this happen, it's a process of a couple of minutes, the iPad would have looked normal, but would no longer have been working for me.
You weren't only concerned about electronic, invasion of your life. You were worried even about physical aspects, and you describe dabbing epoxy and glitter on the case bottom screws of all your machines to help detect tampering.
Yeah, I did a lot to try to prevent tampering and also to detect it if it happened, which is just as important. So the glitter gives you a unique pattern on the bottom. If you examine it from time to time and compare it with a photo that you've previously taken, you can see whether the screws have been opened or not. I kept the material in a heavy safe in a locked room, encrypted on a computer that had its networking hardware physically removed. There was video surveillance. I at one point I experimented with ultraviolet powder on the dial of the safe. It just went on and on because I knew there were significant resources being expended to try to steal this material.
One of the chilling things that Snowden told you, and you tell the story in the book, it was beyond the realms of imagination at the time. Quote, they can literally watch your thoughts form as you type.
Yeah, he doesn't mean they're mind reading, but he argues there's not much distinction. If they don't have to wait until you click something, they don't have to wait until you finish composing an email or entering a search term. They're watching keystroke by keystroke if they're using a particular form of surveillance. Now, this is targeted. This isn't this isn't something that's happening to everyone at all times. It's happening when they have a particular target in mind.
Forgive me being parochial, but Australia, an American ally, all too often an unquestioning one, part of the Five Eyes Network, how involved was our government in all of this? Snowden certainly seems to suggest that we were in cahoots.
Well, the alliance between and among the Five Eyes countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, UK, and the US, could not be any closer. They're as nearly fully transparent to each other and teaming up against the world as can be imagined. And the most intrusive tools used by the NSA are shared with Australia, and Australia shares its access points with the NSA.
At one point, and we're running out of time, you found that your own name was in the Snowden archive. Fortunately, or in an NSA file that predated his leaks.
Right. Well, so this was quite creepy, to be honest. He's leaked this document, these documents, to me in 2013, and as I review them, I find my name in the files as the subject of a proposed criminal investigation because of stories that I had written years earlier. And I knew they were sensitive stories at the time I wrote them, but I did not know there was an FBI investigation to try to find and punish my sources.
Barton, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you very much, and congratulations on Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the Surveillance State. It's come strongly recommended by the Little Wireless Program. Barton, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, now a staff writer at The Atlantic. Oh, the book, incidentally, is published by Bodley Head. Good on you, Barton.